This is a Crowd podcast.
I first heard the name Rodney Marks over 20 years ago. I was looking into a strange rescue mission that had happened in April 2001, which made headlines around the world. A daring flight by New Zealand Air Force Hercules to pick up an ill scientist and others from the American base at McMurdo. There was secrecy and wild rumours of nuclear accidents, of patients with burns. Officials provided contradictory details. Everyone acted like there was something to hide. I realised then that there was a darker side to Antarctica, that it was not just the continent of heroic explorers and scientists that I'd always dreamed of visiting. And that's when I learned that a man had died at the South Pole just the year before. In all my investigations, including the others in this Secret History series, it's the unanswered questions that have driven me on. The Rodney Marks case is no different. How can a man die at a scientific base run by the world's superpower, the United States, and nobody knows why? In this final episode, I'm going to go through each of the theories about what might have really happened to Rodney Marks in May 2000. This is the secret history of Antarctica. One theory that the coroner examined was that there was nothing suspicious about Rodney's death at all. That Rodney had killed himself. He drank the methanol, knowing exactly what it would do. A tragedy, but no mystery. However, nobody we've spoken to for this series thinks this is right. The thought that Rodney would take his own life just doesn't fit.
I do not know how he wound up ingesting methanol. I mean, it is a mystery. I do not at all think that he committed suicide.
That's Tony, his supervisor. And here's Dave.
Because knowing Rodney, thinking that he would do suicide or drink methanol, no way.
Rodney was happy, his friends and colleagues say, doing well at work and in a committed, loving relationship. He and Sonia planned to get married. In his final report, the coroner also points out that if Rodney had drunk the methanol intentionally, surely he would have told somebody during those 36 hours when his condition worsened. At one point in the afternoon of the 12th of May, Rodney had broken down. He started crying and said to the doctor, "I just want to know what's wrong with me."
They had surmised that he was a smart man and that he knew what methanol had the potential to do, and also that when he went to the doctor several times during the day before he died, he was so frantic and desperate to know what was wrong with him, he would have presumably disclosed that he had taken methanol had he known that he'd taken it.
The coroner ultimately concludes there's no evidence to suggest suicide, so he rules it out. So if not suicide, then something else. The second theory is that the methanol entered Rodney's system purely by accident. This seems possible. Methanol was everywhere at the base. Rodney was in contact with it every day. He used it to wipe down his telescope to prevent contamination. We've already heard that Tony Stark had stressed to his student how careful he had to be when using it.
With methanol, you could absorb tiny amounts of it through the skin, and that's not a good idea. And so in the safety talk, I would say, well, you know, if you're going to use methanol, you know, make sure you wear gloves because it's toxic.
Could Rodney have made a mistake, not worn his gloves? McElroy suggests not. The concentration of methanol in Rodney's system was so high, he must have drunk it, he concludes. So what about another kind of accident? He'd had a long day at work, say, and just grabbed the wrong bottle, methanol instead of ethanol.
No way.
Dave.
I mean, he did like to drink. Would I say he's an alcoholic? Probably not, for he's an average Australian. He likes to drink. So to think that he would mistake that and then drink it, And I know there was, it was about a 4 ounce consumption or something is what I had heard, which is significant amount. Extremely unlikely.
Unlikely, perhaps. But impossible? Detective Wormald wanted to know if Rodney could have picked up a bottle of methanol by mistake. The questionnaire that the National Science Foundation finally agreed to send to those 49 winter rovers on the detective's behalf contained a number of questions about the storage of the methanol. How and where was it kept? How was it labelled? I asked Rodney's supervisor about this.
You have to always have these flammable solvents in well-labeled containers. And in this case, they were in glass bottles, sort of a brown 1 liter bottle with a screw top, and labeled with the various hazard symbols on it.
Rodney's friends, family members and colleagues who spoke at the inquest, and those we've spoken with for this series, all say across the board how intelligent Rodney was. He knew how toxic methanol was. He was unlikely to make such a fatal error. But what about the home brew?
Prior to me being there, there was a still, I believe, that was built.
Gene.
You will have heard or know about what they call toast juice, which was a bottle which still existed when I was there, and it had clear liquid in it. It was pretty much straight ethanol. I don't know exactly.
Could these home brewers have got it wrong? Could they have cooked up a batch, not of ethanol, but methanol? This is where Gene sits. 2 decades on, he's still resistant to the whole possible first murder at the South Pole line.
I still generally believe, although it's not 100%, that he probably consumed the methanol unknowingly in a bottle of bad alcohol. To me, that makes the most sense.
The coroner looked into this. On the second day of the inquest in 2002, he referred to an analysis of the toast juice on the base. An ethanol level of 71% was found in the homebrew, but no methanol was detected. The coroner does acknowledge that, given the time that had passed between Rodney's death and the homebrew analysis, almost a year, the sample they tested would not have been the same as the toast juice that Rodney may have drunk. Another curious detail is those needle marks in Rodney's right arm. The doctor thought they looked at least 3 to 5 days old. Might Rodney have accidentally injected himself with something fatal? In his final report, the coroner suggests not. The only drug they found in Rodney's body was methanol. And the coroner thought it was unlikely the methanol had entered his system intravenously, because the levels in his blood were so high. It was far more likely he drank it, he says. So, if this wasn't a mistake on Rodney's part, what other possibilities remain?
Well, I really only see two.
Michelle, the forensic pathologist.
That he intentionally drank methanol, knowing what it would do, or that someone gave him methanol in something that he was drinking, again, intentionally. We don't know how or who, but it is very suspicious. I don't know his pre-mortem state. You know, was he depressed? You know, those kinds of things from a psychological standpoint is something that we always look at when there's a suggestion or possibility of an intentional suicide. And I don't find that in anything that I've read. So that really leads me to think that there is a strong possibility that this was intentional by someone else.
But why? Even if someone intended to kill Rodney, or if it was just some sort of prank gone wrong, what would be the motive? We've already heard about the intense stresses of living in Antarctica. The isolation and the cold can make tensions implode in ways that would be completely unreasonable elsewhere in the world. The research from the psychologist Larry Palinkas is striking.
Oftentimes, small, insignificant things can get blown up out of proportion. It used to be the case, and probably still is the case, that many times the source of social tension was having to listen to the way your fellow crew members chewed their food at dinner time.
I've heard some other theories over the years about causes for animosity and resentment.
There's definitely a us and them that does develop a little bit.
His first year down there, Dave had been a cook. Then he returned as a carpenter. He says there was a hierarchy, with scientists on top, the manual workers beneath them. Dave and the electricians, plumbers, and construction workers were all employed directly by Raytheon, the contractor. They worked long days. Dave's team in particular had their work cut out for them in 2000, building the new research station.
You've got certain tasking to do. Obviously, your evaluation is based off of how well you perform. You get a little bonus, so you want to keep good with that.
The scientists, on the other hand, weren't employed by Raytheon, but by universities, far or faceless institutions. Rodney was conducting research for the University of Chicago, and he had a single point of contact, Tony Stark.
In order to avoid confusion, the direction of his work only came from one person, and that was me at the time.
Dave says for this reason, he thinks the scientists felt less answerable to authority. As long as their experiments were going well, they could relax, he says.
You may see them taking naps in the middle of the day, in the lounge, watching movies. Then they could work for an hour and then not do anything for the next 2 days. They're too busy to go do their shift in the cafeteria because they have their science experiment. But you just saw them hanging out for 2 days doing a lot of nothing.
A sense of us versus them can develop, he says.
Every season down there, it happens, no matter what station you're at. But for the most part, it doesn't escalate into anything really bitter.
What about tensions between the scientists working in the same field?
Yeah, there's definitely in the same field, absolutely. I don't know all the particulars, obviously, because I'm not in their world, but you start talking with them about the different experiments, how this is going to catapult their career afterwards or potentially hurt it. So they've got these other people there that potentially are competition for the bigger picture of their overall career and where they're going with things. So there occasionally can be tensions. Most of the time, it's pretty mellow from what I've seen, but you do see that once in a while.
Another hugely important aspect that comes up again and again in my conversations with people is the relationships. Someone told us a relationship he had on the ice ruined some of his friendships. He told us, people didn't react well to happy couples down there. It was kind of like you were rubbing it in their faces. He went on, it's unfortunate, but if you're trying to piece together the psychological makeup of a group, that's a big part of it.
42 men, 8 women. Some were in relationships, some weren't. Some hooked up where they were there, that I'm aware of, and others didn't. So yeah, I mean, it's an interesting dynamic, obviously, to be in that kind of situation.
There is typically only about 30% women, and the choices within that of somebody that you're going to get along with, whatever, your interests will go to the most interesting person there. So in the real world, you may not find that person as interesting or pursue them as hard, but when there's nothing else, people can obsess about an individual, and they just, that is the only person, and they get fixated, and there's no other distractions. It brings out weird behaviors in folks.
So looking back on it now, you don't think that Rodney Marks died of an accident?
I couldn't say for sure, but I think there is more likely that it was not an accident than an accident.
Could any of the stress and tension have led to Rodney's death? Is that how he ended up with a glass of pure methanol in his system? This is where that mysterious prawn bottle becomes relevant. It's a detail that's occupied me a lot over the years. People mentioned they'd seen this bottle on Rodney's desk, by his computer. It had a motif of a prawn on the side, they said, and curious writing that no one could understand. They thought he'd been sent it as a gift. Detective Wormald was particularly keen to find out where this bottle had come from and what was in it. But he never did. They never found the bottle, nor tested what was in it. Darren threw it away while clearing up after Rodney's death. This is what Darren later told the police. His words are read by an actor.
I can't remember when it dawned on me that potentially this bottle could have been a bad bottle, but it must have been early in 2001.
Early in 2001. So at least 8 months later. Darren hastily emailed New Zealand police to let them know. But it was too late. The bottle was long gone. Interestingly, the coroner doesn't think the prawn bottle is significant. This is what he wrote in his final report. His words are read by an actor.
Given the toxicology findings of methanol intoxication and the availability of methanol at South Pole Station, it is unlikely that the item is of relevance to his death.
For me, though, it's one of the biggest question marks that hangs over the case. So, suicide, accident, or foul play? Multiple people we've spoken to for this series think there's more to it. In an email, Tony Stark told me, "I think he was deliberately poisoned, although his poisoner may not have actually intended to kill him. What actually happened will remain a mystery, unless the person involved makes a confession." In the end, the coroner rules that there's no evidence of foul play. But he says he cannot rule it out. Ruling it out once and for all, he says, would need a full and proper investigation. And it's that investigation, not full and proper in the coroner's verdict, that is the biggest story here. Who was responsible for that? When someone dies in mysterious circumstances while under medical care, the role of the doctor is crucial in any investigation. And questions were raised at the inquest about Dr. Robert Thompson, about whether he did everything he could have done as Rodney lay dying. We've spent months trying to reach Dr. Thompson, but were unsuccessful. Reports suggest he hasn't been heard from in 15 years. So we are relying on the doctor's own testimony at the inquest, interviews he's done elsewhere, and the coroner's report to present his point of view. According to those who knew him, Dr. Thompson kept himself to himself.
A little eccentric and a little quiet, reserved. He would go out to the bar and hang out with Rodney and a few other the people that were regular bar folks that would... That was the end of the day. They would always go in there and have a couple drinks, and he tended to go in there quite a bit and would be a little bit more talkative once he had a few drinks in him, but he was a little bit more quiet.
In an interview with CNN in 2001, Dr. Thompson talked about his fascination with the ice. His words are read by an actor.
"I did not simply want to work in Antarctica, which is a very large continent, but I wanted to go to the South Pole and winter over. The reason is it was the most extreme and adventurous place for me to practice medicine on Earth that I could think of."
Extreme and adventurous is right. Dr. Thompson was the sole physician for 50 people, a structure that still exists today.
"I carried out all the functions of biomed alone."
From the off, Dr. Thompson had a tough time of it. A month after he arrived, he slipped on the ice and fell and suffered a bad back injury. For the rest of the season, he was in extreme pain. It became worse over time, according to the coroner. He eventually had to be airlifted out of the South Pole at the end of the season. His back had got worse, and a disc had ruptured. They needed a replacement doctor, pronto. Dr. Ron Szymanski was that doctor.
"When I went down there in 2000, you were pretty much on your own. There really was no organized medical backup."
After arriving, Dr. Szyminski was asked to take an inventory of all the drugs at the station clinic, Biomed, which was standard practice for new doctors.
There was some discrepancies in narcotics that we had for pain. There was some shortage.
Which he may have been using for his own pain.
Well, that was the assumption. That's why I was told to inventory it. I understand that he was having quite a bit of pain.
We've heard from a number of people that Dr. Thompson may have self-medicated while working at the station because of his back. We haven't been able to confirm this. On the first day of the inquest, Rodney's family asked Dr. Thompson if the pain he was in had impaired his ability to treat Rodney. The doctor replied,
"I don't believe it did. In a crisis situation, which I consider that case to be, I really don't remember my back hurting at all. It hurt a lot the next day because he was a big guy and I had quite a bit of pulling and tugging on him when he wasn't responsive. But the adrenaline was pumping. I wasn't on any medication, so I don't think it impacted at all, to be honest."
More interesting, perhaps, is the question of the blood machine, the Ectochem it was called. We've already heard that this potentially life-saving machine was broken. The lithium battery was dead, meaning that when the machine turned off, it lost its calibration. The Ectochem was a crucial diagnostic tool. But we had problems keeping it running, said the doctor. It was old and clunky.
It required a lot of labor just to keep it operational, and it was known to fail without warning.
Calibrating it took 8 to 10 hours, time he simply didn't have as Rodney lay dying. On that first day of the inquest, the family also asked Dr. Thompson who was responsible for maintaining the machine.
"I'm responsible for calibrating the equipment, and the contractor is responsible for maintaining it."
The contractor was Raytheon. In fact, Dr. Thompson later told the inquest he knew about the malfunction with the machine before Rodney died, and had even reported it to Raytheon.
"Before that episode, and after too."
But it seems nothing had been done. I asked Ron Szyminski about the training doctors received in using this machine. Remarkably, he said there was none.
"No, the doctor that was there before them was expected to teach them how to use the machine. And there was no procedure for routine maintenance. There was no procedure for quality control of the machine."
So does this mean that Dr. Thompson had no training in using that machine?
He may not have, because the doctor before him was medevaced out, essentially.
It seems like there was a curse of the South Pole doctor. There was a string of dramatic rescues around the turn of the century. Dr. Szyminski himself was airlifted out in April 2001 with pancreatitis and gallstones. It was the first ever South Pole rescue in the polar winter, and it made international headlines.
The NSF's point of view was that if I would die down there, I would leave the crew down there without a medical doctor, and that was not an option.
Dr. Thompson's ruptured disc and medevac had been 6 months before that. And the doctor before that, a woman called Jerry Nielsen, who Dr. Thompson had replaced, had also been airlifted out. She made history by self-administering chemotherapy after developing breast cancer on the base. It was weeks before a plane was able to rescue her. A film was made about her, starring Susan Sarandon.
So he did not meet the doctor that was on the winner before him. So I don't know who oriented him to the clinic at all, but it would not have been the previous winner over doctor.
Dr. Thompson never said anything about this himself, so we don't know for sure if or what training he received. We asked Raytheon about the procedures in place at that time for the maintenance of the Ectochem and what training physicians had. They didn't reply. A Raytheon spokesman did tell the inquest that as of 2002, a backup blood machine had been installed at the South Pole station. But that was too late to save Rodney Marks. Dr. Thompson had no backup. With no Ectochem machine to run tests, he was left to his own devices.
diagnosing methanol poisoning in the situation that he was in would be very, very difficult, because you had to have a index of suspicion to really figure out what's going on with the limited amount of resources he had. And I don't think anybody expected methanol to be a problem.
Ultimately, the coroner concluded that Dr. Thompson had treated Rodney, quote, with concern. But did he do all that he could to save Rodney? Big questions were raised at the inquest about his treatment plan. Firstly, regarding the needle marks in Rodney's right arm. Dr. Thompson had noticed them on multiple occasions, and on the afternoon of the 12th of May, he'd even commented to Rodney that they looked well used. This is what the coroner wrote in his final report.
Given the presenting symptoms and without the knowledge that the post-mortem examination ultimately provided, Dr. Thompson should have closely questioned Dr. Marks concerning the significance of the apparently recent needle marks in his right forearm. This may have led to vital information in his treatment of the patient.
Significantly, the coroner concludes that Dr. Thompson failed to carry out certain diagnostic checks. His blood machine, the Ectochem, was down. Had it been working, the coroner says, Rodney's chances of survival would have been seriously enhanced.
Despite Dr. Thompson's efforts to deal with the emergency, no measures were undertaken to reverse this pathophysiology, and he lapsed into a coma.
After he recovered from his gallstone procedure, Dr. Szymanski eventually became the National Science Foundation's first ever medical director. Having seen firsthand the ad hoc resources available to South Pole doctors, he made a lot of changes. He introduced a formal process for medical backup and more rigorous training. I assumed that when he took over as medical director, with a determination to fix all of these seemingly flawed processes, Rodney's, at that point very recent death, would have been one of the first cases he would have looked at. But amazingly, he tells me he never even saw those medical records.
I think NSF did not want to make this a case. So as far as specific questions about marks, I never had any official briefing on that at all.
Right, so you have taken over as medical director and you're trying to fix the medical procedures at the South Pole and make things better, and yet you got no briefing at all on a case where a man actually died there.
Correct.
Why wouldn't the National Science Foundation, I mean, as a duty of care and as having appointed to you this job, why wouldn't they have you examine what happened? I mean, surely the ultimate issue of medical care at the South Pole is a man's died.
I felt that they consider the case closed, I guess, as far as the NSF was concerned. It was never brought up during the time I was medical director.
As I see it, responsibility for the flawed investigation into Rodney's death ultimately rests with those at the top. The coroner praised the efforts of the New Zealand police, but he said there'd been an unsatisfactory hiatus in the investigation, and there were significant legal, jurisdictional, and diplomatic hurdles throughout. For me, key questions remain. Why wasn't the area where Rodney died cordoned off, photos taken, and evidence preserved? Why was that mysterious prawn bottle allowed to be thrown away? Why weren't key witnesses interviewed? Why did the NSF complain about Detective Wormald, who was just trying to do his job? Why didn't they help him locate a staff list? Is it because they did not want an independent investigation? It has seemed to me throughout my own investigation over the last 20 years that the American authorities simply wanted the whole story to go away.
I think that is outrageous. I cannot imagine why someone would question that or have a problem with that. I mean, that's what should have been done.
Michelle Dupree is a forensic pathologist and medical examiner.
That's our job. I mean, that's what we're supposed to do, is to help the families understand, find out what happened, and give them closure as best you can. I can't imagine anyone not wanting that to happen.
Yeah, I do find that slightly alarming.
John Dewdney, Antarctic historian. He led the British Polar Program for some time and chairs numerous international scientific organizations.
Well, I'm surprised that the NSF were so negative, apparently, in dealing with this, although it does butt straight into this jurisdictional issue where the Americans are very hot on not recognizing anybody's territorial claims. And so you can see where the friction would arise.
In the Marks case, I have actual documentation on this, that when the coroner intervened, there was formal complaints from the US government to the New Zealand government. And again, it comes back to the jurisdictional issues.
Absolutely. They would have had to have done that. That would have been required. You know, it's like issuing protest notes over any international dispute. You have to issue the protest note. It's just done. It's part of maintaining your position. And so from the United States point of view, I think they would need to have made a statement like that anyway because of the jurisdictional issue.
As a result of the Marks case, McIlroy made a series of recommendations to the New Zealand government to resolve the jurisdictional issues that seemed to have crippled the Marks investigation. But it looks like those jurisdictional issues still haven't been fixed. Here's John.
No, and they won't be, I wouldn't think. It's an extremely knotty problem, and how you go about it with this group of countries which don't have a higher body over them. It's a group of countries that have come together because they have an interest in Antarctica. It's completely separate from the United Nations. So how do you do it? They work because they're a group of equals in terms of their power at the treaty. So how do you create some sort of overarching jurisdictional process that everybody will agree to?
So if there's a mysterious death tomorrow at the South Pole involving somebody who's not an American, we would potentially face all of the same issues that happened in the Marks case because nothing's been fixed.
I would say that's probably the case, although I would expect that the State Department and NSF will have a better policy in dealing with it now. I don't know that, but I would suspect that that would be the case. Any competent organisation would do that. It's very interesting that you raise this particular instance because I've searched the Antarctic Treaty database for papers put into Antarctic Treaty meetings. There is no mention of it at all by either New Zealand or the United States that I can see. Now, I attended those meetings, and I don't remember this ever being an issue that was actually discussed. My memory is not as good as it used to be, but I think an issue like that I would have remembered.
And isn't that extraordinary? I mean, you would think when this tremendously problematic issue arose that there would be some discussion about how to fix it in future.
Yeah, well, the general issue of jurisdiction bumbles on with lawyers meeting in darkened corners and discussing it probably over coffee, but not much else happens, I don't think, because it is so difficult.
And that's what drives me to tell this story. Who or what did kill Rodney Marks? Was it the first murder at the South Pole? 24 years later, Detective Wormald wishes he could have found more answers. But he was up against an impenetrable brick wall of bureaucracy and diplomatic restraints. As the coroner writes in his summary, there was no indication that a death in similar circumstances would result in any different outcomes. If the coroner's right, that's shocking, because there's a family at the heart of this story. Rodney's parents, two sisters, aunties, uncles, and cousins, who still don't know why he died to this day. In interviews he did with New Zealand broadcasters in 2008, Paul Marks, Rodney's dad, said the family will never know why their son died. But he blamed a culture of alcohol on the ice.
The consumption of alcohol down there wasn't controlled. There was even evidence from just about everybody down there that they had been the previous year distilling spirits of their own.
The National Science Foundation declined requests for an interview. At the time, They said they had cooperated fully with the investigation and that they, quote, hope this matter will finally be concluded for everyone involved, particularly the family and friends of Dr. Marks. Raytheon said it was satisfied with the medical treatment provided. Both dismissed the claims of a bad drinking culture. We asked the NSF if a death tomorrow in similar circumstances at the South Pole would result in any different outcome. They didn't reply. We also approached the New Zealand police. We asked why key witnesses weren't questioned immediately upon return from Antarctica. They declined to answer. We asked them why it took so long for them to start investigating. 2 whole years had elapsed before they first emailed the NSF and Raytheon, asking for a list of South Pole staff. They declined to answer that too, and said they would have no further comment on the Rodney Marks inquiry. Every year, Sonia, Rodney's girlfriend, sends a group email to her old colleagues. It comes in March, a few days before Rodney's birthday, an update from her part of the world, and encouraging people to write to Rodney's mum, Ray, to see how she's doing back in Australia. Rodney's buried in Geelong, the city near Melbourne where he grew up and learned to surf. His gravestone reads, Rodney David Marks, died at South Pole, dearly loved son of Ray and Paul, loving brother of Julie and Yolanda. Thousands of miles away from Rodney's grave, there's a mountain named in his honour. Mount Marks is an 8,500-foot peak on the western side of the Ross Ice Shelf, Antarctica's biggest. If you fly from the South Pole to McMurdo on your way back to the outside world, you can see it out of the window. The glittering Southern Ocean lies just on the horizon. At 90 degrees south, the pole, flags are as ubiquitous as snow and ice. Those of the original 13 Antarctic Treaty signatories, as well as the flags of the United States, the National Science Foundation, and the US Antarctic Program. But unlike the others, the Australian flag stays out as a tribute to Rodney Marks, the only man ever to die at the base there. But this is a land where nature rules. The ice at the pole moves each year by about 30 feet. So, as the years go by, the flag that commemorates Rodney gets further and further away from the base where he died. Eventually, it will disappear. The Secret History of Antarctica is a Crowd Network original. It's presented by me, Stephen Davis, and produced by Anna Stauffenberg. Mixing and sound design is by Rory Alskuri. The music we use is from our partners, BMG Production Music. Thanks to Luis Rodriguez at Sonic Space Lab Music for studio recording, and to Derek Shetterly, John Hogan, and Andy Marr for their readings. Additional material across the series, courtesy of Ngā Toonga Sound and Vision and Getty. To binge the whole series ad-free and for exclusive bonus episodes, subscribe to the Crowd Stories channel on the Apple Podcasts app. You can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music. If you haven't already, take a listen to the first 2 Secret History series. The Secret History of Flight 149 is the tale behind how a passenger plane got caught in a war zone, leaving hundreds of people at the mercy of Saddam Hussein. Hear from the human shields who were held hostage in Kuwait, and from those who spent years searching for the truth. Series 2, The Secret History of the Estonia, is my investigation into what really happened when a passenger ferry sank in the Baltic Sea, killing 852 people. A story of secrets, smugglers and spies that leads back to the Cold War. Find both of those series on the same feed. Thank you for listening.
Crowd Network, a place where you belong.